Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really getting into something fundamental for any law student, fiduciary duty.
Yeah, specifically how it works, or sometimes doesn't work as expected, in closely held corporations.
Exactly. We're not just talking theory. We're using Jordan v. Duff & Phelps as our main case study.
A classic Seventh Circuit case.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the opinion, the dissent. It really lays out the tensions.
The tension between basically an employee who's also a shareholder and the company itself, especially when big things like mergers are happening behind the scenes.
Right. It's a scenario you will encounter.
Okay, so picture this. You've got an employee shareholder, James Jordan. He's got this stock agreement.
Uh-huh. Pretty standard one, or so it seemed.
Then there are these secret merger talks going on at the company, Duff & Phelps. He decides to resign.
For his own reasons, right? Not related to the merger he didn't know about.
Correct. He sells his shares back, like the agreement says, gets book value, and then finds out he might have missed out on a fortune because of this merger.
It's quite the shocker, really. The potential loss was huge.
So the big question we're diving into is, what exactly did Duff & Phelps owe Jordan? What are these fiduciary duties when a company is closely held and there's major news like a merger brewing?
That's the heart of it. Let's unpack the facts a bit more.
Okay. James Jordan, employee at Duff & Phelps, a financial advisory firm. Importantly, it's closely held, not publicly traded.
That distinction is crucial. Very different dynamics.
He signs this stock restriction and purchase agreement,
which basically said, if you leave, you sell us your shares back.
At book value. Seems simple enough on paper.
Very common. Keeps ownership tight.
So late 1983, Jordan resigns. Personal reasons. He has absolutely no idea the company's in serious talks with Security Pacific Corp.
And these aren't just casual chats. They're talking valuation around $50 million.
Now, contrast that with what Jordan got. He sold his 188 shares back, received about $23,225. Book value.
Peanuts compared to what they could have been worth under that merger deal. We're talking potentially over $450,000 for him.
That's a life-changing difference.
It really highlights the stakes involved.
And just to add another layer, that specific Security Pacific deal actually collapsed later in 85.
Oh, interesting. So it wasn't a sure thing?
No. Okay. But Duff & Phelps was eventually sold later to a trust for $40 million.
Okay, so the underlying value, or at least a significant portion of it, was definitely real. Jordan's missed opportunity wasn't just hypothetical.
You can see why he'd sue. He wanted rescission to get his shares back or damages for the money he lost out on.
Which sets up the whole legal fight. Did Duff & Phelps have a duty to tell him about those Security Pacific talks before he sold?
That's the million-dollar question, almost literally in this case.
Or at least the $400,000-plus question for Jordan.
So the district court initially said, nope, no duty, sided with Duff & Phelps.
Right, maybe focusing just on the contract language.
But the Seventh Circuit flipped that decision. They reversed it. Why? What was their reasoning?
Well, this is where that closely held status really comes into play. The Seventh Circuit said, look, these aren't public companies with open markets and tons of disclosures.
Right. Information doesn't flow the same way.
Exactly. So they argued that closely held corporations owe a heightened fiduciary duty to their shareholder employees, more than you might expect in a public context.
Because the relationship is different, more trust involved, maybe, less access to information otherwise?
Precisely. There's an inherent information imbalance, and shareholders are more dependent on the directors and officers for fairness.
And they zeroed in on materiality, didn't they?
Yes. Was the information about the merger talks material? Meaning, is it something a reasonable investor would think is important when deciding to sell their stock?
Especially at that book value price compared to the potential merger price.
The court felt that, reaching an agreement in principle, even if the deal wasn't final, was very likely material information.
But they didn't decide it outright.
No, they said that's a question for the jury, whether it was material in this specific context.
Okay, and what about the timing? That seemed critical too.
Hugely critical. There was this factual question. Did the sale legally happen in November when Jordan resigned?
Or was it technically December when maybe the merger talks were even more solid?
Right. If the sale finalized later, when the merger info was, let's say, more concrete, the duty to disclose would be much, much stronger.
So pinning down that date was key to figuring out when the duty might have kicked in.
Exactly. It shows how details matter in these cases.
Now, Jordan wanted his shares back. Rescission. What did the court say about that?
They thought that probably wasn't going to work.
Why not?
Well, think about it. He wasn't an employee anymore. The stock agreement tied ownership directly to being employed there.
So giving him back the shares would sort of mean giving him back the job, which wasn't really on the table?
Pretty much. It wasn't a practical remedy, given the terms of their agreement. But, and this is important, they kept the door open for damages.
Meaning money. Compensating him for the financial loss from selling without knowing about the merger potential.
Yes. Making him whole financially, even if he couldn't get the shares back.
Okay, but we have to talk about the dissent. Judge Posner had a very different take.
Oh, absolutely. A very influential voice, Judge Posner. His dissent is quite famous.
What was his main point?
Posner basically argued that the stock agreement trumped everything. Jordan was an employee at will.
Meaning they could fire him anytime for almost any reason.
Correct. And the agreement said if his employment ended for any reason, he had to sell his shares back at book value. Full stop.
So in Posner's view, the merger talks were irrelevant because the outcome selling at book value upon leaving was already set by the contract.
That was his logic. He felt the contract covered this exact situation. Disclosure didn't matter because the sale price and obligation were fixed beforehand.
He even called Jordan opportunistic, right? For trying to get merger value after deciding to leave anyway.
He did. It's a starkly different framing of fairness. Puts a heavy emphasis on the written contract.
So how did the majority opinion push back against that? Against the idea that the contract was the end of the story?
The majority didn't ignore the contract, but they brought fiduciary duty back into focus. They said, okay, maybe Duff and Phelps could have fired Jordan.
Under the at-will doctrine.
Yes. But if they fired him specifically to stop him from getting the merger benefits.
Ah, like a strategic firing just before the deal became known.
Exactly. That, the majority argued, would be bad faith. It would be using their contractual power opportunistically to cheat a shareholder.
So the fiduciary duty acts as a kind of backstop, even with an at-will contract.
That's the idea. It prevents the company from exploiting its position, even if the contract gives them broad rights. It's about the reason behind the action. Was it legitimate, or was it designed to deprive the shareholder?
That's a really important nuance. The right to do something doesn't mean you can do it for any reason, especially a bad faith one.
Precisely. Fiduciary duty layers on top of the contract here.
So moving forward from this case, what are the big tests or takeaways?
Two main tests really solidified. First, that materiality test. We touched on it.
Would a reasonable investor care about this information?
Yes. And it's not black and white. It depends on how serious the talks were, the potential impact, all the circumstances. Fact intensive.
Okay. And the second test?
The timing test. When exactly did the duty arise? Was the information material at the point the transaction became legally binding?
Because if the info only became material after he was locked into selling, maybe there's no duty.
Potentially. The timing of the sale versus the timing of the material information becoming known or solidifying is crucial.
And the overall impact of Jordan B. Duff and Phelps, it seems like a big warning shot for closely held companies.
Absolutely. It sent a clear message. You can't just hide behind confidentiality agreements or stock buyback clauses when there's major value-altering news affecting shareholder employees.
There's a duty of fair dealing that might require transparency.
Yes. It highlights that balancing act. The company needs confidentiality, sure. But shareholders need fair treatment and enough information to make informed decisions about their stake.
So for the law students listening, let's crystallize the key learning points.
Okay. First, materiality isn't just rumors. The agreement in principle stage here was key. It showed serious intent.
So the more advanced the talks, the more likely it's material.
Generally, yes. Second, that employment at will twist is vital.
Even if you can fire someone, you can't necessarily do it strategically to deny them shareholder benefits they'd otherwise get if you hide material info.
Right. Bad faith matters. Fiduciary duty limits that power.
Third, the remedy piece. Why no rescission?
Because the agreement linked shares to employment. He wasn't employed, so getting shares back was problematic. Shows how contract terms still shape the outcome, even if damages are possible.
Got it. And materiality isn't a fixed rule, right? It's context dependent.
Very much so.
Yeah.
What's material for a $50 million merger might be different for a smaller deal or earlier stage talks.
Anything else?
Well, the court also talked about what the parties would have agreed to if they'd thought about this disclosure issue up front. It's sort of a hypothetical bargain idea.
Interesting. Trying to fill the gap in the contract with what reasonable parties might have intended?
Yeah, it's a way courts sometimes approach these fiduciary duty gaps in closed corporations.
So, the bottom line. In close corporations, transparency often wins out. Shareholder agreements don't always shield the company from disclosing big news.
That's a very good summary. The duty of loyalty, the duty of candor. They mean something tangible here. Silence when there's a duty to speak can be a breach.
And for students drafting these agreements later.
Be aware of this tension. Think about disclosure. Understand that fiduciary duties might impose obligations beyond the explicit text, especially regarding material non-public information.
So, Jordan v. Duff and Phelps, it really gives flesh to the bones of fiduciary duty in this specific, very common corporate context.
Absolutely. It's more than a definition. It's a real-world illustration of the competing interests and the legal guardrails. Hopefully, listeners feel they've got a much richer understanding now.
Definitely. And maybe a final thought to leave people with.
Go for it.
We've focused on closely held corporations, but what about, say, partnerships or LLCs? They often have similar close-knit structures.
That's a great question. Does the reasoning about heightened duties, information asymmetry, and reliance extend to those forms?
Why or why not? How might the specific legal framework for partnerships or LLCs change the analysis?
It's worth chewing on. The principles might apply, but the specific rules could differ. Something to explore as you get deeper into business associations.
For sure. Understanding these kinds of nuances is critical for advising any private company down the road. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.